Welcome to the session on the history of cardiovascular disease epidemiology. We have some very high quality papers today, and I will give you a full disclaimer. I'm Karen Cruz Thomas. I am a historian of medicine and public health, but I have been asked to stand in on short notice for our commentator who is not able to make it, unfortunately. So I will briefly do some introductions, and then we will get started with the actual papers. The commentator for whom I am filling in is Sarah Tracy, who is the Reach for Excellence Associate Professor of the History of Medicine at University of Oklahoma. She earned a PhD in the History and Sociology of Science from the University of Pennsylvania and is an expert on the history of alcohol and drug use in the U.S. She's also the founder and director of the Medical Humanities Program at University of Oklahoma. Her current work is on Health Revolutionary, the Life and Science of Ansel Keys, who's, of course, a very, very important figure in this history. Are we going to go, who's going first? Jeremy Green is assistant professor, and I believe soon to be associate. he's up for review, of the history of science at Harvard University. He is an instructor in medicine in the division of pharmacoepidemiology, say that 10 times fast, and economics, sorry.
It's a sadistic.
Okay, and pharmacoeconomics, Harvard Medical School, associate physician, Department of Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. His first book was Prescribing by Numbers, Drugs, and Definition of Disease, which received the Rachel Carson Award. And his current research is on the expansive role of pharmaceuticals in public health practice in the 20th and 21st centuries. Our next speaker, Sejal Patel, is currently the senior research historian at the NIH Office of History, where she's been exploring the NIH's influence on research styles. She received her PhD from the History and Sociology of Science program at Penn as well, and was a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Health and Society Scholar at the University of Wisconsin. She's currently working toward a book project on community approaches to health and disease, named with the interesting title of The Fat and Happy Town. Should I do errands?
We can introduce him when he comes, I guess.
Okay, great. So let's go ahead and get started.
Well, thanks so much, Karen. And it's really delightful to be here. And thanks for coming out. This is a panel of three very different histories of how public health is done. Both how public health, and particularly how the science of epidemiology sees itself as a historical science. And so my paper will take on certain dimensions of what it means to talk about historical science as a historian. We presented an earlier version of this paper. It's written with my colleague David Jones, also a duly trained historian and physician. And we generated a very interesting conversation with historians. I'm particularly interested to see how this paper at the intersection of history and epidemiology works with those of you coming from more epidemiological persuasion. But to begin, our talk today calls for the closer examination of historical narratives that are pervasive within the cultures of medicine and public health. And I want you to consider, for example, this graph from the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly reports in late 1999, which at the close of the 20th century was grasping to sum up what had been the most important public health accomplishments of the 20th century. And as you can see here, visually depicted, at some moment in the 1960s, the devastating epidemic of coronary heart disease reaches its peak in the United States and begins to recede. And the CDC notes this as one of the greatest public health achievements of the century. But once noted, however, this is really where my narrative begins, this decline launches a protracted debate about which factors were most responsible for this momentous transformation. Did the decline in cardiovascular mortality demonstrate the power of modern medicine, or the efficacy of public health campaigns. From the 1970s on, as epidemiologists struggled to develop new techniques to answer this historical question, they hoped their answers would then guide health policy for the future. There's an element of looking backward to look forward. And our interest in this question began actually reading a recent publication in this in 2010, but hinges around a central irony, which is that although this research is designed to guide choices between medicine and public health, these models, these studies of trying to understand whether prevention or treatment is more important in explaining the reduction of the decline of the cardiovascular epidemic, they always end up celebrating the value of both in nearly even proportions. Our talk today will describe how the decline in coronary mortality came to be seen as a natural experiment for this emerging field of cardiovascular epidemiology, how modeling came to be constructed as a vital tool for addressing that problem, and the kinds of knowledge that these models both wrote in and wrote out of existence in addressing this problem. So first, to set the stage, actually, can I see you to pass me my glass of water? I forgot to bring it those last few feet. Thank you. So heart disease, of course, took a devastating toll in post-war America. By 1960, it killed nearly one-third of all Americans, striking down men, most visibly white men, but men from every rank of society. Led by the American Heart Association, the National Heart Institute, and the President's Commission on Heart Disease, Cancer, and Stroke, the country mobilized unprecedented resources against the scourge. And really, the first tidings of changing forces in the battle against heart disease come from California, where officials in 1964 began to report that mortality from heart disease had begun to decline. That being California, most other national experts dismissed it outright, and this reversal received little attention. It wasn't until the 1970s that cardiologists and the national media began to approach the problem of heart disease as a problem that was beginning to ebb. And so here's this moment in March 1974. This is actually a picture from Abraham Flexner's depiction of coronary artery disease. But a sign of spring emerges when cardiologist Weldon Walker publishes a special communication in the Journal of the American Medical Association claiming that age-adjusted coronary mortality had actually been declining since 1963. And, to say not everyone was convinced is a bit of an understatement. And historical epidemiology, as many of you know, is a fragile science. It's dependent on disease taxonomies, ways of counting people as ways of explaining death that itself is continuously in flux. And this graph illustrates here how there's a rupture in coding schemes between three different iterations of the International Classification of Disease. And I could go into more detail about this later, but you see that the timing of this peak is obscured by these ruptures. So it becomes quite difficult to say, well, exactly when does cardiovascular disease begin to decline? But to resolve the question of whether the decline was real or not, the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute called leading researchers to Bethesda in October of 1978 for what became known as the Decline Conference. Participants agreed that the decline in mortality, now more than 20% from its peak in 1963, was real. And what's more, they saw this decline as, quote, a natural experiment of immense importance constructed on a grander scale than any experimenter could have devised. So what was the new science of cardiovascular epidemiology to do with this natural experiment? It allowed epidemiologists to ask, was the decline due to treatment or prevention? A question with clear implications and consequences for health policy. As one discussant put it, quote, there is an urgent need for better information about the relative impact of each component if we are to make intelligent decisions about the allocation of scarce resources between competing programs. Answering this question, however, proved surprisingly difficult. And this is one of many graphs that were illustrated at this conference to try and hypothesize different ways of thinking about the relationship of treatment and prevention in explaining the improvement of cardiovascular epidemiology. Initial attempts made their arguments on the basis of temporal association. The onset of decline coincided with vigorous efforts to educate the American public about the risk factors of heart disease, especially smoking and diet, and with changes in medical care, such as aggressive control of hypertension, specialized coronary care units, the invention of beta blockers, bypass surgery. And although the concordance of these changes suggested cause and effect, as many debates in epidemiology carried out, critics could always argue that such simultaneity was merely circumstantial. As Jeremiah Stamler, a leader in the field, complained in 1978, quote, "When such multiple socio-medical trends evolve over the years, it is virtually impossible to make a definitive scientific assessment as to the role of each of them singly, and all of them together in causing the decline in mortality rates." So frustrated by their inability to solve, quote, "the case of a disappearing epidemic," the conference organizers exhorted researchers to push new data and methods. Many turned to epidemiological modeling. So this is the first robust model on cardiovascular epidemiology that was published in this field by Lee Goldman and Francis Cook in 1984. And their method, which really could have been done on the back of an envelope and perhaps was, borrowed from cybernetics and systems engineering, divided medical care into modules that recapitulated the passage of a patient with coronary artery disease through the healthcare system, identified specific interventions that patient might have encountered along the way, and assigned a value to each. And here you can see below one of these modules, which is really the role of resuscitative facilities, specifically and the coronary care unit. And you see there's some rough numbers that are generated. They're all explicitly estimates. They can be calculated together to form an estimate. And this is basic arithmetic that is being utilized here to do this work. Similar calculations estimating the lives saved by each individual intervention could reveal the contributions of lifestyle interventions against dietary fat, cholesterol, smoking, obesity, and exercise. Now, the authors were quick to acknowledge the subjective evaluation and potential errors in this model, but they were pleased when their modeled interventions, all combined, accounted for more than 90% of the observed decline. That observation led them to think their modeling was onto something. It represented the world as experienced in a robust way. And so for our purposes today, it's also important to notice that the model instituted the shared credit equally between treatment and prevention. And the authors commented on this. They noted that this, quote, "may be as serendipitous as it is accurate." There's a certain humility in the tone of this early work. Now, this first model, if it was a back-of-the-envelope calculation, it was improved in sophistication by teaming up with cost-effectiveness and calculative guru Milton Weinstein. And Goldman and Weinstein developed a subsequent computer model. This is the first computer model I've found in this field. It started with 1980 data and let it run through a simulation with assigned values to predict patient trajectories over time, considering the impact of primary prevention, the transition of from health to heart disease. You see, you start with a population of people who don't have heart disease, yet they then get heart disease and then see actually what happens to them. And by comparing their simulations to historical data, they could determine how much of the decline that actually happened could be accounted for by which interventions they're modeling. And after running this for a decade, the model came within 2.8% of 1990 data, again claimed as a success, and as before, nearly half came from prevention and half came from treatment. So Goldman's simulation allowed for, now this is a very low resolution model, and it found its high-res counterpart in the work of Scottish cardiologist and epidemiologist Simon Capewell. Capewell added more knobs and levers to Goldman's simulation to allow for interactions between interventions and for variable levels of adherence to therapeutics and preventive regimens. His team tested the model on data from Scotland and credited treatment with 40% of the decline and prevention with 51%. But the resolution of the model allowed them to go even further than that. For treatment effects, 10% could be given to coronary care, 9% to treatment of hypertension, 8% from other secondary preventive efforts, and so forth. And so in theory, you have a far more sophisticated way of testing the potential value of line item issues on public health budgets, so that the fine grain of being able to reach into the world of policy and have consequential effects appeared to be more powerful in Capewell's more sophisticated modeling. Now, Capewell moves quickly to deploy this model widely. It shows up in New Zealand, England and Wales, Finland, Ireland, the United States, Sweden, Canada, Italy, and then most recently in Iceland. And each study sought to impact policy by enumerating the contributions of medicine and public health. Although the results did vary, in most cases, Finland, I think, is the strongest exception, credit was shared nearly equally. In the United States, for instance, half is attributed to reductions in risk factors and half to evidence-based therapies. Again, this 50-50 split. So chronic disease modeling has since that time become a booming practice, its own subdomain in the realm of cardiovascular epidemiology. Developed to first decipher the causes of decline, the impact and other models have been adapted to account for the rise of coronary artery disease in other countries, most notably China. And this is a graph from a recent publication from Impact in China here. And As they have gained precision and power, however, they have become more opaque. It is a far cry from the back of the envelope calculations of Lee and Goldman. One cannot actually find in a given impact publication the exact methods that lead to the production. One needs to actually reference through a series of other past publications and have a rather sophisticated knowledge of computer modeling before one actually understands how these models are actually performed. Nonetheless, much can be learned by looking closely at how they operate. And in the remaining time, I want to point out a few issues that present themselves in the transformation of this field when we open up these models. So first, the decline debate provides a critical example of how tensions between medicine and public health, which my colleagues Alan Brandt and Martha Gardner have called a false dichotomy, nonetheless perpetuate themselves in these debates. The competition between prevention and treatment is explicit from the outset. These two are necessarily opposed to one another. As Henry Blackburn wrote in 1975, "These, then, are the battle lines, well drawn, and the conflict of views and attitudes continues." Anxiety about this conflict at the first decline conference led the Swiss researcher Frederick Epstein to observe that, quote, "it would be unfortunate at the stage to play, as it were, primary and secondary prevention against each other. Instead, quote, in order to avoid unnecessary and unproductive controversy, it will be scientifically and tactically preferably to give both primary and secondary prevention their due." And so one wonders, is the predictability of these answers, prevention is always 50%, treatment is always 50%, somehow a convenient response rather than an empirical one? And that's a hard question to answer. Taken the context, though, of the stakes of this debate initially were clear to all involved. In the late 70s, these researchers are working in the shadow of Thomas McCune and Ivan Illich, whose contestations about the role of medicine in public health were very broadly discussed. Widespread concern about the burgeoning cost of healthcare put medicine in particular on the defensive. And given the powerful interests that support both medicine and public health, perhaps it is no surprise that expedient results, which credit half to each, emerge time and again. And here I have an illustration of Lewis Carroll's Dodo Bird, because he may have responded, as he did in Alice in Wonderland, quote, "everyone has won and all must have prizes." But what gets lost in this polarized debate, however, is recognition of how much the categories of medicine and public health themselves had already begun to change by the 1970s. Prevention once meant ensuring the healthiness of lived environments, clean air, clean water, clean food. By the 1960s, however, prevention had moved far away from these progressive origins and towards a strong ethic of individual responsibility. At the dawn of the 21st century, prevention is firmly integrated in regimes of medical surveillance, pharmacological control. Patients must quit smoking, monitor their blood pressure, cholesterol, and C-reactive proteins, and they must take their diuretic statins and other medications. Items that would have been on the treatment ledger in earlier studies are now actually on the preventive side of the ledger. Similarly, the models develop how easy it can be to make subtle adjustments in technique to produce vastly different results. And I have two examples here from Capewell's impact analyses. The initial studies look at decreased mortality rates, and one actually sees very little difference between treatments and risk factors. But then another analysis was run by Capewell's team using a different metric, and the metric here was life years gained. And if you measure life years gained instead of mortality, you actually see a striking difference between the effect of treatment and prevention. And so there's a certain malleability here of which endpoints you're following in tallying the battle between the two. The choice of endpoint shapes both the tenor of the analysis and therefore the resulting policy recommendations. The third thing I want to mention is that these models apply a veneer of specificity on top of a rather messy foundation. And so Capewell's analysis in the United States, for instance, claims to account for 90% of the decline, which it does. But if you look at the variation around that, the range on this estimate goes from 51% to 160% of the actual decline. Now, if we keep that in mind as we move later through this analysis, these models struggled to manage the other, and this is perhaps the strongest point I want to make today, which, you remember the graph I showed you initially where there are about 10 or 11 different possible explanations for a decline in cardiovascular mortality. And at the time of the initial decline conference in the late 70s, there was a very broad set of social environmental factors that are part of the debate. And yet this openness diminishes over time, and it becomes primary prevention, improved medical care, or something else, and then that something else gradually disappears. So, now why does this happen? Part of this answer is obvious. Models can only analyze factors that can be easily quantified, and so we know about these biases. It's no accident that they focus on usual suspects, whether it's smoking, blood pressure, body mass index, or utilization rates of specific medical interventions. Less precise measures, like stress, or other social variables have to be left out. As Michael Marmot conceded in his own foray into this field, quote, stress is excluded from discussions of trends in mortality because of conceptual, definitional, and measurement difficulties. And Capewell's team, itself actually quite interested in social determinants, handles this deficit in several ways. So when impact left a few percent of the decline unexpected, you see down here on the bottom, or unexplained, researchers could sweep everything else into an undifferentiated other. As the team wrote in their analysis of New Zealand results, quote, as planned, the 4% shortfall in the model estimate was attributed to other unmeasured factors. Yet in the abstract, and I've done a bit of work to try and understand where this other goes in the analysis, this shortfall can be finessed. The 4% here was folded into the risk factor category so that 46% came to medical treatment, 54% to risk factors. The U.S. analysis did something similar. The text repeatedly emphasized half of the decline was due to risk factor adjustment, half to treatment, and yet the 9% of other here is actually eliminated from the analysis. So these analyses happen in different ways. And my job here is not really to take Capewell to task. It's really not quite a fair thing. He's not present in this room. At least I don't know that he is. I mean, one of you may actually be Simon Capewell, in which case I appreciate this. But I have, you know, I have chatted with Capewell about this over the phone. He's very over email. He's very amenable to discussing his methods and his role in this process. Sometimes these analyses even deny that the other can exist at all. So in one interesting exchange, one epidemiologist critiques impact for neglecting to consider the impact of air pollution. And Capewell is dismissive. The unexplained 9% of the U.S. decline might simply have arisen from imprecision in the measured variables. Now, this is true as a possibility, but when we consider the findings go across such a broad sweep, remember the 51 to 160%, it does seem expedient to just eliminate these things. And yet, the other becomes a real problem for epidemiological modeling. We can discuss that a bit more. This other, however, in lived experience can't be dismissed so easily, and even in the field of social epidemiology. Even as reductionistic models rise to prominence, other epidemiologists were elaborating the field of social epi. Michael Marmot's famous Whitehall study, of course, demonstrated that CAD mortality correlated powerfully with occupational grade within the British civil service. Subsequent work has linked mortality to relative position in any status hierarchy pretty much anywhere. And others have found innovative ways of writing the social back into this field. Jeremiah Stamler invoked Rudolf Virchow during the Divine Conference to remind his colleagues that CAD, like all epidemics, resulted from, quote, disturbances of human culture. And recently a team from the University of North Carolina has used geographical and temporal disparities to push this point home. The decline of CAD in the United States was not a uniform process. Instead, it begins geographically in California in the Northeast and spreads from coast to interior, from cities to rural areas. These researchers noted that this followed long-standing patterns of cultural diffusion, including, quote, not only aspects of popular consumer culture, such as diet and recreation, but also shifts in productive economic activities, such as manufacturing and extractive industries to high technology and service economies. And so these proponents, I think it's a glimmer of an ecological approach. It's not to impugn the contribution of medicine and public health, but they want to bring other causes and other policies back into the discussion as they are systematically being forced out but through, inadvertently oftentimes, through the methods used in cardiovascular epidemiological modeling. So that being said, and I want to be very clear on this point, it is wrong to cast Capewell merely as a reductionist villain in my tale. As other work makes clear of his, he has a long-standing interest in social determinants. His team, there's a few headlines of his other work. His team's impact analysis in Canada acknowledged other factors like consumption of fruits and vegetables and secondhand smoke could play a significant role in CAD epidemiology. And in non-impact studies, Capewell has emphasized the importance of deprivation on every aspect of CAD. Here's a quote from him. Socioeconomic deprivation has a profound effect on the risk of having a first myocardial infarction, the chance of reaching a hospital alive, and the probability of surviving the first month. This presents a striking paradox. If Capewell remains committed to a progressive tradition of public health, he is nonetheless in this other work doing more than other epidemiologists to narrow the focus onto precisely quantitative variables. And this is a constant tension, I think, in social epidemiology, as will be explored in the other papers. Finally, we're left to wonder what work, at the end of the day, this form of decline modeling actually does. From the outset, as we began this talk, researchers sought answers that would guide policy choices between medicine and public health. But useful advice has almost never emerged from a discipline that always apportions responsibility equally. Instead, the research has served to support the value of both camps, arguing resources should not just be shared broadly, but actually increased overall. Better utilization of evidence-based therapies could save even more lives. More aggressive campaigns against risk factors could prevent even more deaths. As Capewell's team concluded time and time again, quote, both are urgently required. So to conclude, and this is my final slide, the campaigns against coronary artery disease since the 1960s have pioneered knowledge and strategies that have blurred the division between medicine and public health, I think quite appropriately so. At the same time, CAD has become a primary example of the increasing power of social epi and the risks that such increasing power takes when other forms of social argumentation get left out of analysis. These developments could have depolarized the field, but that has not happened. Instead, cardiovascular epidemiology appears to remain preoccupied by models that, by their nature, categorize interventions as either medicine or public health and exclude all not easily quantified variables, while providing no useful policy guidance. This research continues to appear, it continues to be read, it must be serving some function. But what is it? For whom? I leave this to you as open questions, and I look forward to the discussion. Thank you very much.
Our next panelist is Sejal Patel. If I could ask to silence your cell phones for the rest of the panel, that would be great. Thanks. That's it?
Yep.
Can I close your computer down?
Okay.
I don't have slides for this presentation, so you can turn that off. Thanks, everyone, for joining us this afternoon during lunchtime at that. My talk is called Methods and Management, and it's about the Framingham Heart Study. Prospective population-based longitudinal studies of health and disease are indispensable to epidemiologists and other types of health investigators. The Framingham study, in particular, has provided some of the most valuable insights into the causes of heart disease and has contributed, in part, as we've learned in Jeremy's talk, to the dramatic reductions we've seen in heart disease mortality, at least over the past 40 years. So the Framingham study is, hands down, one of the most important, one of the more better known and the most valued studies in the post-World War II period. I think that that goes without saying. Given it's now an arguably celebrated place in American health research, it may surprise some of you to learn that in 1965, a period when the Framingham study was reaching its most richly productive phase, NIH administrators wanted to terminate it. In 1965, the Framingham study, which was a prospective follow-up study of 6,000 individuals whose medical, behavioral, and social circumstances had been painstakingly documented over 15 years, was just 5 years short of the 20 years of funding originally committed to its investigators. Given the support of health research on the part of the federal government, and mind you, this is the boom years for the NIH, the 1960s, this decision on the part of administrators was abrupt, unexpected, and from the perspective of Framingham investigators, completely indefensible. Now, as I'm sure as you all know, the Framingham study did not end in 1965. It has been proudly funded by the NIH to this very day. Nevertheless, the controversy that I'm going to talk about today provides a very useful window into the politics of science administration at the NIH, especially, I would argue, for epidemiologists and other population-based health investigators, because it highlights the challenges that prospective population-based studies pose to administrators and offers a possible explanation for why such studies, though continuously supported by the NIH, have remained marginal relative to lab and clinic-based studies of health and disease. So I'll begin this talk by explaining what the Framingham study was, according to its investigators, in 1965, and by elaborating on this idea of a population laboratory. I'll then explain the new managerial constraints that confronted NIH administrators like James Shannon, who was one of the most revered directors of the NIH, and why these constraints made the Framingham study so problematic. A goal for this presentation is to bring an understanding and an awareness of the Relationship Between Methods and Management, which is the title of my talk, how concerns with accountability, efficiency, and productivity have influenced what we have come to regard as a rigorous science, or more perhaps on point, the type of science deemed worthy of NIH funding. So in 1965, investigators regarded the Framingham study as what they called a population laboratory. The investigators found the study so useful in this capacity as a population laboratory because of how little was understood about the natural history of heart disease, and that was the first issue, as well as how to study heart disease in populations, and this also extended to chronic diseases of other sorts more generally. For example, Framingham investigators regarded the development of heart disease screening procedures and the collection of accurate statistics about the incidence and prevalence of heart disease as important contributions of the study itself. Also, Thomas Dauber, who was the principal investigator of the Framingham study, he explained that the study occupied, quote, a rather unusual position to investigate the possibility and validity of various simpler methods of epidemiologic study using the complete prospective study as a standard of comparison, end quote. And as an example of the use of the study in this sense, Jerry Kornfield developed multiple logistic regression analysis, which formed the methodological basis of the risk factor approach. That's just one example of the methodological developments that the Framingham study as a population laboratory was able to provide. As a population laboratory, the Framingham project was designed to be open-ended or flexible about its potential findings and the length of time needed for meaningful insights to emerge. And this was a feature of the study that would lay at the heart of the controversy. The Framingham program was not designed to elucidate a narrowly defined set of variables, as was the case with experimental studies. Rather, its investigators cast a wide net with respect to population size, the data they collected, and the study's overall time frame, because for them, tracking the natural history of disease was a descriptive endeavor that required lengthy and careful observation, as well as an openness to nuance and a willingness to follow leads as they emerged. Along these lines, the Framingham investigators intended to add areas of study to the investigation as they saw fit. For them, not tapping this resource to its fullest extent would be to, quote, waste a tremendous investment already made, end quote. Accordingly, Framingham investigators had decided to expand the scope of their study in 1964 to follow the development of stroke and other cerebrovascular abnormalities, and their idea was to continue adding areas of inquiry as leads presented themselves in the data. So implied in these comments was that as a population laboratory, the Framingham program had become an observational resource that investigators could tap for years to come. As Dauber commented in a progress report, the Framingham population should be followed, quote, indefinitely as long as follow-up remains satisfactory and useful information is being obtained, unquote. In other words, whether to continue, expand, or curtail a population laboratory depended on how consistently and accurately data had been collected and how useful they were in conducting scientific evaluations. And in this capacity, the Framingham study had proven itself quite invaluable. So again, my point is to differentiate the Framingham study from an experiment with more bounded objectives and timeframes. But it was this distinction that made the study problematic from an administrative point of view in the 1960s, a period when new managerial expectations had been posed onto the NIH, as well as other federal agencies more generally. And I'd be happy to talk about and elaborate on this new managerial and administrative culture that was coming into play in the federal government during this period and the discussion, if you'd like. Beginning in the late 1950s, NIH administrators had received increasing calls to demonstrate the efficiency of their operations and the accountability of their science. These calls culminated with the Wooldridge Review, formed in 1965 to, quote, study how the NIH spends its approximately $1 billion budget to judge whether the American people are getting their money's worth, and to recommend any changes in organization or procedure that would increase the effectiveness of the program, end quote. The Wooldridge Review was the most thorough investigation of the NIH up to that point in its history.
But more significantly, the review drilled home the need for the NIH to adopt new managerial values, especially with respect to the prospective assessment of program payoff and returns on investment prior to the commitment of funding. According to members of the Wooldridge Review Committee, quote, an extraordinary justification should be required for the support of any program involving the expenditure of more than a few million dollars a year, end quote, and the Framingham study fit this criteria. The failure on the part of administrators to implement such assessments on programs like the Framingham study, and the Framingham study itself was kind of reviewed in detail by the Wooldridge Committee, got a lot of attention in Congress and left administrators like James Shannon, who again was the director of the NIH during this period, obligated to review and assess programs according to these new managerial approaches. In this climate of heightened managerial oversight, James Shannon found experiments easier to defend than open-ended population laboratories like the Framingham study. The reasons for this are that experiments are bounded. They have bounded objectives, and as a result can be designed with a good deal of operational finesse to see to it that these specific objectives are met. And as I described, the Framingham study was intentionally designed without such discrete objectives. As a result, Shannon dismissed the various reviews of the Framingham study that applauded the detail and consistency with which data on the Framingham population had been collected and the projected usefulness of this population laboratory to future studies of health and disease. As he and another NIH administrator discussed, quote, the survival of the Framingham study cannot be decided without more intensive analysis. And they noted how, quote, if Framingham is to continue, there must be new project leadership, added biometric competence, revamped program design, and above all, convincing projection of valid and useful information to be gained by continuous investment, end quote. So again, as you can see, this language of program payoff and return on investment becomes kind of integrated into these administrative discussions, and they really do use this lens in judging the merit of scientific studies during this period. So what ultimately led Shannon to propose terminating the Framingham study was his decision to evaluate it as an experiment with discrete objectives rather than a population laboratory. Shannon recruited Jerry Cornfield and Tavia Gordon, and these were two NIH biometrists, to evaluate whether the study had identified a connection between high blood pressure and serum cholesterol. And these two were kind of the original variables that kind of drove the need for doing this particular study. And that's why Shannon asked these two biometrists to focus on those two variables alone. And the question was whether an additional 5 years of funding would add useful insights on the role of these two variables in heart disease. So like, would continuing the study for another 5 years really tell us more than we already know about heart disease, or about high cholesterol and blood pressure? So accordingly, Cornfield calculated the number of additional coronary cases that would likely develop within the next 5 years, and the degree of certainty the projected new cases of heart disease would provide about the role of serum cholesterol and high blood pressure. And he concluded how, quote, in his statistical opinion, while these additional cases may strengthen existing findings, nevertheless, the single factor effects are already reasonably well established, and additional cases can be expected to make only somewhat more precise findings which are already precise enough, end quote. So in effect, he explained to Shannon that the study had fulfilled its objectives with respect to serum cholesterol and high blood pressure, and that 5 years of additional funding wouldn't really do much to change the results that they had in these two areas. But even as they admitted this to Shannon, Cornfield and Gordon continued to support the Framingham study as a population laboratory. Gordon defended it as a, quote, a proving ground for new techniques, a testing area for new hypotheses, a school for investigators, and finally a consultative resource, end quote. With respect to the study's function and methodological development, Cornfield maintained that his methodological work would yield, quote, order of magnitude improvements in analyzing all the large-scale epidemiological studies underway, end quote, and how, quote, it seems not improbable that the termination of observation in Framingham would lead to the termination of these analyses as well. So So even these biometrists, I mean, the Framingham as a resource, as a population laboratory, was valuable across the board to various types of people working at the NIH. And the biometrists found it completely indispensable to their own work on method development, et cetera. And they themselves were very keen on having it continue. But despite their efforts and the efforts of other epidemiologists who fervently defended the study, Shannon concluded that the study had indeed met its original objectives with respect to blood pressure and serum cholesterol, and that an additional 5 years would have little effect on enhancing these results. And this conclusion of his was what ultimately led to the controversy over the Framingham Heart Study, which, as we know, resolved in the favor of the Framingham investigators. But this is my conclusion. The 1965 controversy over the Framingham Study gives us insight into why experimental and laboratory-based styles of research have long dominated the scientific portfolio of the NIH. The 1965 attempt to end the Framingham Study had less to do with its failure to meet scientific standards and more to do with its inability to meet emerging managerial values along the lines of program payoff. Shannon's decision to terminate the Framingham Study resulted from his proclivity to conflate scientific merit with an ability to demonstrate accountability in a prospective and highly circumscribed manner. A managerial ethos that was far better suited to evaluate experiments rather than population laboratories. And Shannon himself had a primarily laboratory-based background, so he was inclined, I suppose, as well to favor and better understand these kinds of studies. These new managerial values lay at the heart of subsequent controversies over the support of field trials at the NIH, and also of trials of natural populations and population-based studies more generally, longitudinal population-based studies. While the Framingham Study was allowed to continue, most new proposals to conduct population laboratories were either denied or administered to death, as was the case with the Diet Heart Study. This is also a period when administrators shamed investigators for, quote, neglecting randomization and the double-blind trial due to inconvenience, or worst of all, for having misguided faith in endpoints that perniciously soften with time, end quote. So again, implicit in these comments and in the decision not to fund certain studies is a preference for the experimental approach of a well-designed randomized controlled trial. If you have to do a population-based study, make it a randomized controlled trial, in other words, over that of observational research conducted via population laboratories. The administrative rationale to end the Framingham Study was no match for the counter-response of its advocates, especially given the NIH's long-held commitment to keep science in the hands of scientists and away from an unnecessary federal and administrative intrusion. Since 1965, NIH administrators have funded the Framingham Study at levels that have allowed it to continue as a long-term population laboratory. Over the course of its now 62-year history, the study has expanded to include the second and third generation of family Framingham Study participants, has become a major resource for genome-wide association studies, among other lines of inquiry, and has produced well over 1,000 publications to date. So it has certainly proved its worth as a population laboratory. Indeed, while the experimental approach remains dominant at the NIH, field trials, including the Framingham Study, continue to be funded by the NIH. And in this sense, the 1965 controversy and its resolution and the subsequent success of the Framingham program has served to secure a permanent, albeit less prominent, place for population laboratories in the overall research portfolio of the National Institutes of Health. Thank you.